Hello, and welcome to Science World. If you're a Star Trek fan, surely you remember Mr. Spock's Vulcan mind meld. This past week, scientists were able to do the real thing, a real person-to-person mind meld. Scientists have created clumps of tissue and test tubes that are strikingly similar to actual developing brains. And we'll learn about the new giant Magellan telescope that's being built in Chile. A super telescope that will produce celestial images 10 times sharper than the Hubble Space Telescope. This and much more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Science World's Bob Doty tells us about a recent experiment that is linking science fiction with science reality.
If you're a fan of the Star Trek TV shows and movies, you may remember the Vulcan mind meld, a special technique that the character Mr. Spock would often perform. Vulcan natives in the sci-fi classic, such as Mr. Spock, were particularly skilled with an ability that allowed them to merge their minds with the essence of another person's mind purely by using specialized contact fingertip points.
Our minds are merging, Doctor. Our minds are one. I feel what you feel. I know what you know.
Well, this past Tuesday, scientists said that they were able to achieve the first real-life human-to-human mind meld with one member of a research team using the internet to send his brain signals to control the hand motion of another colleague who is sitting across the Seattle campus of the University of Washington. While this accomplishment isn't as much of a major development in concept, it still was another step toward the progress scientists have been making for years toward developing and refining brain-computer interfaces. With a brain-computer interface, signals that are generated by one brain are converted into electrical signals, which are then translated by a computer into commands that can move devices, such as a mechanical arm or a computer cursor, or, as it's been seen in more and more studies, how it can affect another brain. The scientists say that they next plan to conduct an experiment that would allow them to transmit more intricate information from one brain to the other. If that works, they then will expand their experiment by conducting it on a larger pool of subjects. Reporting for Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Birds are a major threat to aircraft, especially at takeoff or at low altitudes. While most bird strikes go unreported, those that are investigated by a forensic team at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington. Roseanne Skirbel has the story.
In 2009, minutes after U.S. Airways Flight 1549 took off from New York's LaGuardia Airport, pilot Chesley Sullenberger radioed the control tower.
Cactus 1549, turn left lane 270.
This is Cactus 1549. Hit birds. We've lost thrust on both engines. Returning back towards LaGuardia.
Okay. Sullenberger had few options and made an emergency landing in the Hudson River. The passengers and crew were evacuated safely. His plane had hit a flock of Canada geese.
So the Canada goose is a beautiful bird. I love birds. But there's a place for birds, and there's a place not for birds. And you do not want birds around the airfield, especially large-bodied birds.
Carla Dove identified the birds that brought down Flight 1549. She's director of the Bird Identification Lab at the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, where she manages a reference collection of 620,000 bird specimens housed in floor-to-ceiling cabinets on the sixth floor of the museum.
It's over 150 years old. We have probably about 85% of the diversity of birds of the world represented here. So there are 10,000 species. We have about 8,500 in our collections.
Feathers and debris scraped from airplane windshields or wiped on a paper towel from the inside of an engine arrive here in plastic zip bags, which Dove sorts through each morning. Each year, she analyzes some 10,000 cases.
We are probably the only full-time lab that's dedicated to bird strike identification. We receive feathers from basically from all over the world, military bases, commercial airfields. As long as the material comes from an aircraft that's an American-flagged aircraft or lands at an airport where American aircraft land, we will accept that under our FAA contract for identification.
In this day's mail, she's sorting through feathers connected to an incident with an Air Force plane over Niagara Falls, New York, in July.
And these are the feathers that were received. So we open these up and you can already see that we have some color and some pattern on here. These are very beautiful feathers. This is a small bird, though. This is a tail feather from a small bird. So I have an idea of what I think it is.
Dove immediately turns to cabinets behind her, pulls out a bird from one of the drawers, and matches the feathers.
Bird strike solved. This is an American kestrel.
But it's not always so easy, even with 20 years on the job. Sometimes Dove must look for clues in the feather's structure under the microscope. She compares what she sees with a reference collection of microslides for a positive match. And if she has only tiny bits and pieces to go on, Dove turns to DNA analysis.
Which is a little snippet of DNA that we use. We have an online library that we match up our unknown sequences to, called the Barcode of Life Library. Part of that library was made from specimens from this collection, from the tissue samples that we have stored from our specimens.
DNA analysis has improved the ability to identify the species in bird strikes by nearly 30% over pre-DNA years. Dove says knowing the bird culprit is the first step in addressing the problem.
Once you know what the birds are, the wildlife biologists will make recommendations to the airfields and the airports. The engineers will take the data on the weights of birds, and they will use that when they design new engines and new aircraft parts to make those parts withstand certain bird weights at certain speeds.
Dove says with more flights than ever before and an increase in birds of the sky, more collisions are inevitable. However, her hope is that identifying the species will lead to changes in management that can save lives and property. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's time again for the Science World Quick Quiz. In a few minutes, you'll hear about the new giant Magellan telescope that's being constructed in Chile. It's named after European explorer Ferdinand Magellan. What was Mr. Magellan best known for? Did he A, lead the first expedition to the South Pole? B, was he the first major European explorer of the Caribbean and North America? Or C, was he the first to organize an expedition that completely circled the world? Think about it. See if you can come up with the right answer. We'll reveal the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
Researchers have nurtured human cells into pea-sized clusters of tissues with striking similarities to actual embryonic brains. Steve Barragona tells us how this could provide a unique opportunity to study how disorders such as schizophrenia and autism develop.
The researchers began with stem cells, which can grow into any type of tissue in the body. With a little chemical coaxing and a protein scaffold to grow on, they followed the same developmental steps that human brains do. They formed distinct regions, resembling those found at about 9 weeks after conception. Some even had the beginnings of a retina. Jürgen Knoblich at the Austrian Academy of Science directed the research.
All of these steps we have in our cultures to a level of precision that is totally unexpected. But if you zoom out and look at the whole is just not a brain.
Instead, writing in the journal Nature, he and his colleagues call them cerebral organoids. Not quite brains, but similar. But Knoblich says these brain-like blobs cannot replace what is between your ears. For one thing, although many of the parts are there, they are not in the right places. He says it's like a car gone wrong.
You have an engine, you have the wheels, but like the engine would be on the roof, and then the gearbox would be attached to that car would never drive. But you could still take that car and analyze how an engine works.
What these cerebral organoids excel at, Knoblich says, is offering a picture of how the brain develops and how that development can go wrong. One example is a condition called microcephaly. Patients with the disorder develop very small brains and are severely mentally disabled. Knoblich's colleagues took skin cells from a microcephaly patient and reprogrammed them into stem cells. Lead author Madeline Lancaster grew them in the lab.
The immediate thing I noticed was that the overall size of the patient-derived organoids was much smaller.
When Lancaster examined how the cells inside the organoids were developing, she found they were different from normal brains in an important way. This early in life, stem cells are usually multiplying and making more stem cells. But in the microcephaly patients, Lancaster found the stem cells had already started differentiating into the cells that carry signals in the brain, called neurons.
The stem cells were not expanding like they should, and instead were already making neurons too early. And we think that this depletion of these stem cells leads to the overall size decrease because in the end, less neurons can be made.
These test tube brains could also be put to use studying more common disorders like schizophrenia and autism. Those conditions do not typically show up until later in life, Knoblich says.
But it has been shown that the underlying defects already occur during the development of the brain, and we're confident and hope that we might be able to model some of these defects in our organs as well.
But he adds one thing they cannot model with these organoids right now is the circuitry of the brain. Connections have not formed at the stage of development these pseudobrains reach. And since they have no blood vessels to supply food and oxygen, they're unlikely to develop much further. And he's not sure scientists will ever be able to recreate the complexity of the human brain in a test tube.
I mean, besides the fact that I think we would then run into a very severe ethical problems, I do not think this will be possible.
So keep your head on your shoulders. Scientists are not likely to replace it anytime soon. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists have shown they can cripple some aggressive cancer cells by disabling a single protein in the cells. Researchers hope to develop drugs that can be used alongside chemotherapy to treat some malignant cancers. Jessica Berman reports.
Ether lipids are highly elevated in aggressive cancer cells, and by disabling the enzyme responsible for their production, researchers have been able to disable malignant cancer cells. Ether lipids are normally found in cell membranes, so it makes sense that their levels are high in aggressive tumors, because tumors need the nourishing fatty molecule to divide and grow at an accelerated rate. Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, led by Daniel Nomura, converted skin cells into aggressive tumor cells in culture and then disabled an enzyme called AGPS that's critical to the formation of ether lipids. They also injected mice with both cancerous skin cells and aggressive breast cancer cells, and the rodents quickly developed tumors. But disabling AGPS, Nomura says, hindered the ability of the cancer cells to grow and spread.
They can still proliferate, at least in culture, but in tumor models in mice, we could basically completely suppress tumor growth.
Nomura says cancer researchers have known since the early 1950s that ether lipids play a role in cancer growth, but this is the first time scientists have shown how the fatty molecule facilitates cancer proliferation. He says ether lipids also exist in lower levels in benign tumors, and Nomura hopes blocking AGPS will prevent those tumors from becoming malignant. Researchers are now trying to develop a drug that targets AGPS, increasing the chances that chemotherapy will cure many hard-to-treat cancers.
Certainly, I don't think an AGPS inhibitor is the cure-all for every cancer, but it would probably be combined with other chemotherapeutic agents.
An article on the role of ether lipids as a driver of aggressive cancers is published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Students heading back to school for a new year might need to add a new element to their periodic table of elements in chemistry class. Science World's Siri Nyrup tells us more.
Swedish scientists claimed this week that they have fresh evidence that confirms the existence of a previously unknown chemical element. The new super-heavy element has been unofficially called Unun Pentium and is listed as number 115 in the table of elements and has an atomic weight of 289. Element 115 was discovered in 2003 by scientists at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, working with researchers from the Joint Institute for Nuclear Research in Russia. Scientists say this element probably won't have any practical purposes, unlike others such as iron, oxygen, or even uranium, since it is unstable and has a short half-life of about 220 milliseconds. In creating the element, the researchers bombarded a thin film of americium with calcium ions, which made it possible for them to measure photons in connection with the element's alpha decay, a process that unstable atoms can use to become more stable. A committee of experts will review the new findings to decide whether to recommend further experiments before the discovery of element 115 is acknowledged. The element's temporary name, ununpentium, is a hybrid Greek and Latin word that loosely translates into 115, its place in the periodic table of elements. It will be given an official name once its existence is confirmed. Reporting for Science World, I'm Siri Naira.
Do you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Well, let's find out. A new super telescope being built in Chile was named after European explorer Ferdinand Magellan. What was Mr. Magellan best known for? Did he A. lead the first expedition to the South Pole? B. was the first major European explorer of the Caribbean and North America? Or C. was he the first to organize an expedition that circled the world? Well, the answer is C. In 1522, Magellan's expedition became the first to circumnavigate the world. Unfortunately, Magellan himself was not able to complete the entire voyage since he was killed in battle along the way. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Scientists working at the University of Arizona's Seward Observatory Mirror Lab in Tucson, Arizona, have recently begun casting the third of seven mirrors for the Giant Magellan Telescope, or GMT. Each of the mirrors is 8.4 meters in diameter, and they will be assembled high in the Andes Mountains in Chile. Construction of the Giant Magellan Telescope is set to end in 2019 and will begin its science operations in 2020. When complete, the GMT will be one of the next class of supergiant Earth-based telescopes and will produce images that are 10 times sharper than those currently being produced by the Hubble Space Telescope. Scientists say that the GMT promises to revolutionize our view and understanding of the universe. Michael Long, the vice president of the Giant Magellan Telescope Organization, which was founded to design, build, and operate the GMT, joins us today for our one-on-one segment to tell us more about this new super telescope. What is the Giant Magellan Telescope, and what will it do?
GMT is a giant telescope. It will be the largest telescope in the world when it's completed. It sees things in the optical range that which your eyes see. So it looks at light that's arriving from distant parts of our universe in the same area that your eyes would see. And what it's going to do, it's a scientific instrument. It's designed to address sort of the fundamental questions about our beginnings, the beginnings of our universe, the beginnings how stars form, how planets form. So there's a huge list of fundamental questions that scientists are looking for answers for, and this instrument is designed to accomplish that.
I understand the facility is under construction right now. What's being done?
It's in the early stages. It will be built in an observatory in Chile, in the southern part of the Atacama Desert. And any instrument of this sort, before you even get to the stage of pouring concrete, you've got a lot of design work and other pieces that come together. So in this first last few years, we have started with the large primary mirrors, the mirrors that are 8.4 meters, roughly 25 feet across. And we finished one of them. The second one is being polished. And this weekend, we just completed casting the third mirror.
When you're talking about mirrors and you're talking about actual construction of the Giant Magellan Telescope, we're not talking about normal one-mirror operation here, are we?
No, this is a very special configuration. There are going to be 7 of these large primary mirrors, 7 8-meter diameter mirrors in a circular array with 1 at the center and 6 around the periphery. So the total diameter is approximately 25 meters across.
What are some of the plans for its use once it's constructed, and how will the GMT play a key role in deep space exploration?
The types of science questions that the telescope is designed to address are in many different areas. First, because of its diameter, it has tremendous light-gathering capability. In other words, it can gather light from far greater distances and far greater back in time than existing telescopes. So the intention is to use the GMT to actually examine literally the first stars that formed in the universe whose light is just now reaching us. And these would be giant stars, very, very large compared to the stars we see today. So that's one area of research. Another is to observe the very beginnings of galaxies that formed, when galaxies were composed of maybe thousands of stars rather than billions of stars. It's also going to be able to address the questions of what is dark matter? How much is it? How is it distributed in our universe? And dark energy, the unknown material or force that's causing our universe to expand even faster today than it did yesterday. And finally, perhaps one of the most exciting aspects of this is to be able to observe planets around other stars, what is called exoplanets, and to see how these planets form, to be able to take images of planets roughly the size of Earth and examine the atmospheres of those planets, look for evidence that biological activity.
What really caught my eye in reading about the GMT was the fact that it's purported to produce images 10 times sharper than the Hubble. How's this so?
You know, the sharpness of an image is proportional to the size of the lens or the mirror. So the larger the diameter of the mirror, the sharper the image can be. That's just a basic fundamental fact of physics and how nature works. The Hubble telescope is only 2.5 meters. This telescope will be 25 meters. So 10 times the size, 10 times the resolution.
Space telescopes versus a ground-based telescope. And I understand the advantages of a space telescope is that while it's in space, it's away from Earth's atmosphere. So how will the GMT be able to overcome atmospheric distortion?
Perhaps one of the most exciting aspects of this telescope is the development of technology that's called adaptive optics. Space telescopes with no atmosphere, the photons that are coming from some distant part of the universe, go directly to the camera or spectrograph that's ever being used. In the case of an Earth-based telescope, that same light has to first traverse through our atmosphere. And if you've ever looked up at night, you've seen stars, and they twinkle. And the twinkling is caused by turbulence overhead. Heat causes air to rise and fall, winds go overhead, and that moving air causes the light to take different paths. Doesn't come directly to this telescope, it bounces here and there as it comes down and distorts the image. Well, in the case of the Giant Magellan Telescope, the secondary mirrors, the mirrors that reflect the light a second after the primary, are actually very, very thin and very flexible pieces of glass. And there are little magnets, hundreds of them on each mirror. And the computer adjusts the shape of that secondary mirror to adapt to the changing direction that the light is coming from. In essence, adapts the mirror to compensate for the turbulence in the atmosphere. And it does so thousands of times per second. This is being experimentally evaluated on the Magellan Telescope that exists at the site right now. And this is actually a 6.5-meter diameter mirror, so it's not such a big change to go from there to the 25-meter. But it is working, and it's working very successfully on the Magellan Telescope.
That was Michael Long, Vice President of the Giant Magellan Telescope Organization in Pasadena, California. Thanks so much for listening. We'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. You'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday, as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.